All right, thank you. This meeting is called to order. Please silence all your electronic devices. Amy, please call the roll.
Chair Joe Lombardo.
Here.
Vice Chair Lamarca.
Here.
Democratic Ranking Member Joseph, excused. Representatives Alvarez.
Here, ma'am.
Antone. Campbell.
Here.
Kennedy. Caruso.
Here.
Cassell.
Here.
Chambliss. Clemmons.
Here.
Duggan.
Here.
Gossett Sideman.
Here.
Griffiths.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Jaeger.
Here.
A quorum is present.
Thank you. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. All right, today we got one bill and two presentations. The first bill, well, the only bill, is HB 551, designation of eligible telecommunications carriers by Representative Barnaby. You are recognized, sir, to explain your bill.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, Vice Chair, Ranking Member. Ladies and gentlemen, Merry Christmas, everybody. All right. HB 551 authorizes Florida's Public Service Commission to designate certain entities as eligible telecommunications carriers for the specified purpose of providing lifeline services to rural and low-income communities. This bill will connect eligible Floridians to necessary telecommunication services and allow them to communicate with family, emergency services, school resources, and potential current employers. HB 551 is another key step in achieving our goal to improve connectivity throughout the state. I ask for your favorable support.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions on the bill? No, but we do have an amendment. You are recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Chair. This amendment places an extra layer of clarifying language in the bill. It specifies that the authority given to the Public Service Commission is only applicable to the designation of lifeline providers and not to commercial providers as a whole. That is the amendment.
Do you have any questions on the amendment? We have public testimony on the amendment? On the bill, all right. Debate on the amendment? And you are welcome to waive close on the amendment.
Waive close, Chair.
All right, now we're back on the bill. We have public testimony. And without any objections, it is the amendment adopted by, and now we are back on the bill. So public testimony, we have one. Shantae Jones from AARP Florida is a proponent of the bill. All right. You're speaking? No? Just waving in support? All right. We have debate on the bill? No? I didn't think so. You're welcome to close on your bill.
Thank you, Chair. Waive close.
Amy, please call the roll.
Chair Joe Lombardo?
Yes.
Vice Chair Lamarca?
Yes.
Representatives Alvarez?
Yay.
Antone? Campbell?
Yes.
Kennedy?
Yes.
Caruso?
Yes.
Cassell?
Yes.
Chambliss? Clemmons?
Yes.
Duggan?
Yes.
Gossett Sideman?
Yes.
Griffiths?
Yes.
McFarland?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Jaeger?
Yes.
Congratulations, your bill is passed. You're favorable. All right, so next up, we got two presentations. So our first presenter is Mr. Robert Wimmer with Toyota Motor Group of North Carolina, or North America. Sir, you are recognized.
So I'd like to thank the subcommittee for inviting us here this afternoon to speak. I'm Robert Wimmer with Toyota Motor North America. I've been with Toyota 20 years. My background's mechanical engineering, and I'm currently the director of the Energy and Environmental Research Group that is part of our Regulatory Affairs Group in Washington, D.C. So I'd like to speak today on how Toyota approaches meeting our customers' needs in a sustainable fashion. And when I say sustainable, I mean from an environmental standpoint, a consumer needs standpoint, as well as a business standpoint. So those three are key to our view of sustainability. We have a global corporate environmental commitment. It has six challenges. I will speak today primarily on the first challenge, which is ultimately zero emissions out of our vehicles by 2050. The other challenges include manufacturing, recycling, use of water, general environmental sustainability type of challenges. So when we look at the vehicle, we look at more than just the vehicle. It's a complete system. So what we think about, what comes out the tailpipe, is what we refer to as tank to wheels. So you might have gasoline, electricity, or hydrogen, and then what comes out of the tailpipe of all the types of vehicles, whether it's a small sedan, all the way up to a big SUV. So that is tank to wheels emissions out the tailpipe. The other that's just as important is the well to tank. So what it takes to manufacture that fuel, that electricity, or that hydrogen. All those have to be combined and considered when we look at the environmental impact of the type of vehicles that we all that Toyota produces and that we all drive. So I will use the term electrification or electrified vehicle. That is because we view that as the entire range of vehicles that Toyota produces and part of a portfolio approach to electrification. So that provides variety of vehicles and meets the consumer where they need to be and gives them choices. So in our vernacular, an electrified vehicle can be anything from a battery electric, which is just a battery electric motor and that drives the wheels, through to a plug-in hybrid, which is something that makes use of an electric motor as well as an engine and can still be plugged in. Then your standard hybrid vehicle like the Prius, which again is a small battery, a gasoline motor, or a gasoline engine and electric motor. And then finally a fuel cell that uses hydrogen, electrochemically converts that hydrogen into water and electricity and is driven like a battery electric, just on the hydrogen. So why do we choose this portfolio or this approach? It's because it provides the right vehicle at the right time, at the right place. So wherever that consumer is, whether it's in whether that individual's in Florida, California, or Kenya, the vehicles are right for whatever they need. It satisfies their needs in all markets, but we do see a rapid expansion of these electrified vehicles because it helps improve the efficiency and reduces the emissions of all types of vehicles in all applications. And that's sustainable decarbonization. So just in the US, our portfolio approach is shown here, a range of hybrid vehicles. I'll point out some of those, the Sienna, the upcoming Camry, the Sequoia, and I believe one of our, the Crown, they are all hybrids. You cannot get any of those with just a standard internal combustion engine. It comes along with that small electric motor, small battery. Proves the efficiency up to 40% of those vehicles. Consumers love them. They don't have to change their approach. They fill them up like they do a conventional vehicle. Gives them improved fuel efficiency and in some cases better performance. We also have plug-in hybrids, full battery electrics, and then the Mirai fuel cell sedan that we're currently selling in California. And just some of the numbers there, over 5 million of these electrified vehicles sold in the US to date, and nearly 25 million globally. In the heavy duty segment, fuel cell buses, fuel cell trucks, as well as fuel cell utility vehicles. So we are focusing a lot of effort on the commercial segment, primarily the powertrain, not the vehicles themselves. So we are basically an engine producer, fuel cell engine producer for those vehicles. So these are just some of our electrification announcements over the next 5 years. I won't speak to all of them. I will highlight these three. So we have invested nearly $14 billion or committed to invest $14 billion in our new battery manufacturing plant in North Carolina. This will produce the equivalent of 300 to 400,000 vehicles a year worth of batteries in 2030. Those will range from hybrid batteries all the way to full battery electric vehicle batteries of upwards of 100 kilowatt hour battery packs. Solid state batteries coming in 2028 that'll improve range and lower costs. And then ultimately, we expect by 2030, about a third of our vehicles will be all electric. But on the flip side, that still means two-thirds will have internal combustion engines. So we look at battery resources as something that we have to be careful of. We have to use them sustainably. And that's because our analysis, our view, is that both the materials and the supply chain are insufficient to meet global needs in the near term, maybe through 2030. So we have a new metric, is the CO2 reduction per kilowatt hour of battery. So let me explain that a little further. So if you have 100 vehicles, these little drops, each are an individual vehicle, 100 of them with standard ICE engines will average about 250 grams of CO2 per kilometer. So if you take one of those vehicles and turn it into a battery electric vehicle with a single 100 kilowatt hour battery, that'll give you roughly 300 mile range electric vehicle. That reduces the average CO2 out of that 100 vehicles to 248 grams per kilometer of CO2. But if you take that same 100 kilowatt hours of battery and put it into a hybrid vehicle uses about 1.1 kilowatt hour batteries, so very small batteries. You can hybridize 90 of those 100 vehicles and turn them into a hybrid vehicle. A hybrid vehicle gets roughly 40% better fuel economy than a standard gasoline vehicle, and you see that the average CO2 of all 100 vehicles now is at 205. That's a 30 times reduction in CO2 relative to BEVs. So in our view, if you have a limited supply of battery materials, it makes a lot more sense to take those limited battery materials and make hybrid vehicles than pure EVs. It just goes a lot further for CO2 reduction. Finally, I'll just talk real quickly about some of our heavy-duty fuel cell vehicle activities. We're moving into Class 8 tractor trailers. We have an assembly line that is going to begin producing these fuel cell systems, 200 kilowatt hydrogen fuel cell systems here in the U.S. beginning next year. And we're also working closely with fuel station providers to improve and bring those stations online, starting on the West Coast, but working east as there's a demand for this technology. Other fuel cell applications, small and large stationary power plants, port equipment, and then we're also working with a supplier in Japan to build electrolyzers that will produce the hydrogen. And we've also have a program in California at our port to generate renewable hydrogen, green hydrogen from biogas. In addition, there's electricity and heat. So we use the hydrogen to fuel our vehicles, the electricity we sell back to the grid in California, and then the heat is used on site for our port operations. And finally, we don't want to forget the 200 million plus internal combustion engines that are on the road today in the US. We feel strongly about the development of low carbon liquid fuels. Here's a quick chart that shows the green lines are low carbon liquid fuels that have roughly a 40% carbon intensity reduction, E15, and then gasoline. So you can see with a standard ICE, if you use a low carbon liquid fuel, you'll produce roughly 60% of the CO2 on a well-to-wheels basis of a conventional gasoline vehicle, and then all the way up to the plug-in hybrid that produces only 22% of the amount of CO2 that would be generated from a gasoline vehicle when using this low carbon liquid fuel. And that roughly works out to be about the same CO2 reduction as you would see from a battery electric using typical grid electricity in most states around the country. And we proved that this fuel works. We did a 1,200-mile road trip this spring with a variety of different vehicles, a standard Tundra, a Camry hybrid, and also a plug-in hybrid, RAV4 plug-in hybrid. So this fuel works well in conventional, new, old vehicles. It's a solution that could be applied anywhere in the world to gasoline vehicles. So finally, what we believe are the three tenets for sustainable vehicle decarbonization: all technology options to meet consumer needs, accelerated vehicle electrification, and then low carbon drop-in fuels. So appreciate your attention. Thank you, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Kennedy.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make sure I got the data correct. So when we look at CO2 emissions, for an IC engine, we're looking at 250 grams per kilowatt hour. And for a pure EV, we're looking at 248 grams per kilowatt hour.
So that is a that is an average for that 100 vehicles. So that's if you drive an average ICE vehicle 1 kilometer, you produce roughly 250 grams of CO2.
So we're looking at a reduction of 2 grams per kilowatt hour from
that,
internal combustion to a pure EV.
For that average of 100. So the reduction is 100% for that single vehicle. It's just when you look at 100 vehicles, that zero now reduces the average for that 100 vehicles to 248.5.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, sir, Mr. Weimer, for your presentation. Good morning, or good afternoon. Long afternoon. Yeah, here we go. Florida collects a fuel tax, and we use it to build our roads and maintain our roads. And I'm all for zero carbon emissions and all that. But how does Toyota see the resolution of these lost revenues due to the move towards electric vehicles?
One, we tend to step back and let the states decide how they want to do that, choose to do that. In our analysis, the bulk of the wear and tear on roads is from heavy-duty vehicles, not from light-duty vehicles. So if it's purely based on where the road damage is coming from, it's really not related to light-duty vehicle use. But clearly there's a financial reason, need for that, those taxes to be paid. And we tend to step back and not take a strong position on that because that's really up to state by states. We're working with some of the states on this. There's often discussion about VMT, trying to measure the vehicle miles traveled to come up with that. That gets challenging because every manufacturer has different systems to do that. How do they go about doing that? So we work with the individual states to come up with solutions that fit their needs, whether that be VMT if necessary or other registration type fees. We just don't believe there should be, it has to be related to the amount of fuel. It can't be for or against the technology in that higher taxes for a, that's above the average of an ICE using gasoline. Want it to be fair and equitable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your response. Does Toyota's vehicles have the technology now to track and report mileage of a vehicle to a state agency if we were to require that?
I do not know. It would depend on the system, but I do not know that. We monitor the vehicle, the miles traveled internally on board the vehicle. I just don't know how that could be transmitted. I'm not
thank
familiar
you.
With that.
Thank
Representative
you.
Griffiths, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. It looks like Toyota's obviously got a game plan on how to meet consumer demands. What type of engine does Toyota sell the most of? Hybrid, gas, electric? I don't want to know the make of the car, but what is the type of engine that's sold the most?
So right now this year, we're going to sell roughly 30% of our vehicles are hybrid. So they do have internal combustion engines. So that would mean that, you know, other than a percentage of fuel cell vehicles and battery electrics, most of our vehicles have internal combustion engines, ranging from four-cylinder all the way to eight-cylinder engines in the U.S.
Thank you.
Representative LaMarca.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your presentation. I think you brought some common sense to what we're all trying to get to as far as the environment, but more importantly, how that looks when you have a blend of products. In this slide with the over-the-road freight vehicles, trucks, when we're talking about road damage, you're talking that's where a lot of that comes. If we were to have a fully battery, electric over-the-road tractor trailer and set up like that, what's the weight of that compared to a current ICE engine tractor trailer?
So you would still have the same federal limits, 80,000 pounds on maximum for the vehicle. So that's one of the reasons why we're looking at fuel cell powertrains as opposed to battery, because they add a few thousand additional pounds for the powertrain over a diesel truck. But a battery electric could be as high as 20,000 pounds additional weight for the battery pack over a diesel. And that cuts into the maximum weight the vehicle can carry, so you lose productivity from that vehicle by carrying that much battery.
Go ahead. Quick follow-up on a different subject, because your presentation was very helpful for a lot of us who have heard other types of presentations in this space. Low-carbon drop-in liquid fuels. Can you just give us a little background of...
So, yes, this is a type of fuel that's a gasoline blend. So the base stock is gasoline. They add bio components. So at least the fuel that we were testing in our vehicles, 40% CI reduction, and that comes from the processing of the fuel. So it has roughly... I don't know the percentages, but the bulk of it is gasoline with 15% ethanol, and then other biocomponents that reduce the overall carbon intensity of the fuel to a 40% through, and they, I believe, use the argon-GREET model to calculate that. So it's a standard-approved fuel that you can run in any vehicle.
Representative Yeager, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation. Going back to when you discussed the kilowatts, the larger batteries versus EV versus hybrid, right? So I think it's 100 kilowatt, you said, for EV?
Yes.
1.5 for an EV, is that right?
No, a battery electric, if you were to use a 100 kilowatt hour battery in a battery electric. So I believe Tesla is like an 81, and when you get up to some of the larger EVs, it's easily 100 kilowatt hours. And a typical hybrid, a Toyota hybrid, has about a 1.1 kilowatt hour battery. So that's where for 100 kilowatt hours, you can make about 90 hybrid vehicles.
Follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with that, then, I mean, what that basically means is that's a lot less lithium needed then, right? Which means the mining of lithium, the whole process, then as you go back to well to tank, right? You're reducing a lot of environmental impact, cost, and everything else when you're doing that, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Alvarez, you are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, thank you so much. So as EVs become a prominent question that we're trying to figure out how to make an inclusive policy, I appreciated where you said that Toyota believes it's not just when we put the car on the road, but from the very beginning of how we source all the materials through the end. Have you all been in your planning or thinking about the end state of the vehicles? Because a lot of concern from first responders to tow truck companies to landfills to the ability to recycle, that's a big concern we're hearing from the street as we begin to manage and become or try to plan a program of how to implement this as a policy for Florida. So What's y'all's take on the end of life of one of your vehicles?
We are working on that very carefully, working with the states in that area, trying to encourage the federal government to come up with a national standard, because our fear is that individual states will have different battery tracking and recycling standards, which would be a nightmare for the industry. So we really are working hard on a standard that can be accepted nationally and maybe even have some international line up well with international standards, because the tracking of these batteries, when we're talking tens of millions of vehicles on the road 20, 30 years from now, is going to be a huge challenge. And we really are looking for some national or consistent legislation on how to do that. But we're all for that, and we support that.
Sorry, take another bite of the apple on something, because you bringing up federal standards. Current EPA suggested policy that's floating out there. We're hearing how practical is current manufacturing and engineering design to get to that point, and over like roughly a period of time.
Well, are you referring to the 67% EVs by 2032?
Correct.
The challenge is the infrastructure, the consumer, and the actual ability to move all these vehicles in the marketplace. If we knew that there would be that huge demand, we could move towards achieving those goals with higher volume. We can't, I don't believe, get to those levels in that short of a time frame, but we're much more concerned about consumer acceptance and the ability to recharge, the minerals, the supply chain, all of these factors that would prevent us from getting there. The manufacturing capacity, as you can see, we've committed nearly $14 billion to a battery plant that will get us a long ways towards that goal by 2030. We've also signed a large agreement with LG Chem for a second battery facility in the U.S. to support that. So we're moving towards that direction from a manufacturing side. We're more concerned with the uptake of the vehicles in the marketplace.
Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is going back to Representative Alvarez's subject matter with regards to recycling, is Toyota engineering designing batteries with recycling in mind?
Yes, we are. We're working closely with Redwood. It's the largest company in the U.S. that is doing battery recycling. So we've been working closely with them for a couple of years, and actually much longer on recycling our hybrid batteries. So we have a very good understanding of how you can disassemble these batteries in a for recycling. There's different processes to do that, different design techniques for recycling there than might be for repair and replacement or of individual modules. So yes, that goes into the design process, from day one. That's again why it'd be great to have a national or an international standard, so you can design that into the battery instead of worrying about dozens of different standards for recycling.
Thank you. Thank you.
Rep. Gossett-Seidman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I don't know if anyone knows, but Henry Ford actually built an electronic vehicle with a battery the size of that podium, and it lasted about 20 minutes, but it's kind of a fun note. I wanted to ask, Toyota had a big announcement about a plant in North Carolina, I think. Is there any plans for something to that effect in the state of Florida? And the second part of that question is, how are the concerns of environmental issues being handled with the impacts of gases and habitat destruction upon the mining of some of the cobalt and lithium?
So I can't speak to future manufacturing facility plans, so I'll have to pass on that question. I'm sorry. But we work closely with our suppliers on those sort of issues, all of our minerals, the child labor issue, the environmental impacts of the production of those minerals, where they come from. As we know, that's a huge issue as well. So those are all things that we're working very closely in trying to do our best to ensure best practices from the mine mouth all the way through to delivery here in the U.S. when we begin to process materials, and it's under our complete control. So yes, we're doing our best and trying, relying on our suppliers to adhere to the Toyota standards for those products.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. And I wondered also about the standards that the federal government is setting for eventually a full capacity, roads full of EVs. Is that even possible in a non-perfect world? And, you know, a lot of my friends, if I could add, who have EVs, have a second or a third vehicle. And in fact, a couple weeks ago, the retailer for a different company in my district actually closed its lot and moved into a trailer with staff by one person. So I don't know where we're going on this in general, but if you could sort of answer both questions, that would be great. Thank you.
The infrastructure is growing. Our belief is that it's not ramping up fast enough to meet the required number of vehicles that are going to be placed on the road over the next 10 years. We feel that there's the money that is out there from the federal government as well as from private industry is a good jump start, but it's going to roll out slowly. When you hear 18 months to 2 years to get permits and connection to the grid in different states around the country, that's a delay. There's other delays that are in the raw materials for some of these electrolytic steel that's used in many of these chargers or in the transformers that are required for the chargers. There's supply chain challenges with that. So there's many things that lead us to believe that the rollout of the chargers is not going to be as aggressive as has been predicted by many sources.
Thank you.
Rep. Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. You mentioned concerns for consumers, and we know, obviously, anytime you build a consumer product, you know, labor costs are always going to determine, you know, whether or not those prices increase. So when we talk about electric batteries, can you tell us from a labor standpoint, where are these batteries built, manufactured, and are there any conversations federally about ensuring that we keep those, you know, building those here or building batteries here to keep those costs down and keep jobs here in America?
I think in general, the way the incentive structure, the federal incentive structure is currently that there's huge incentives to build the batteries here. And that was part of our calculation when we decided to invest $14 billion in our battery facility in North Carolina because of those incentives. And also the American workforce is the best in the world. So clearly, we're not going to have a problem staffing that facility and having high-quality workers do those jobs. So we're very, very confident that that facility, as well as the joint facility with LG Chem, will meet all our needs.
Rep. Yeager, one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry, but so you said you're in D.C. So by what you're seeing today and what my research I've done is hybrid to me is a very sensible solution in many different ways. But it seems like the federal government, I know this, we're in the state, but what you're seeing up there, I mean, it's like we're, this whole thing is skipping over the EV or the hybrid model, hybrid stuff, policy-wise, everything else, we're skipping over hybrid technology totally to go to EV. I mean, are you seeing that? Are you confirming that from what you're seeing the federal side? Are we just ignoring the hybrid technology overall as the solution? We're looking at 60% EVs by 2030, 67% by 2032, new EPA standards. Where's hybrid falling at? Why is it being ignored, in your opinion?
The hybrid technology was recognized 15 plus years ago in California as a important technology, and they promoted it for a short period of time before jumping to zero emission vehicles. And hybrid is viewed, I think, by the federal government as an advanced ICE, And unfortunately, they lump that into the same category as any other internal combustion engine vehicle. So their view is that we've got to get to zero tailpipe emissions. That is not Toyota's view. Again, we believe that we will have all the options available, and if the market says at some point in the future we want fuel cells or we want battery electrics, we'll be prepared to provide them in whatever percentage of customers want those vehicles. The regulations are the regulations, and we will do what we must do to comply with the federal and any state regulations that we have to.
Oh, we got one more question. Representative Gatsa-Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir. As a follow-up to the questions about the battery plants, Ford discontinued and closed its, did not follow up on his plans for a plant in Marshall, Michigan, due to thousands of residents coming out against the facility, despite it offering many jobs to the people there in a distressed area. So, do you have any kind of pushback from your plant, from the residents at your plant site that is planned now or any future plant sites? And if so, how do you handle those?
I'm not aware of any residential pushback in our plant in North Carolina, our battery plant in North Carolina. Toyota has a history of going out and meeting with residents, meeting with interested parties as soon as plants are announced, and really working closely with the community to make sure those concerns are addressed quickly, whether it be environmental concerns for endangered species, tribal concerns. We've had these, you know, work through these issues, and issues probably is too strong of a word, but we've worked through ideas in a number of places, and we're comfortable with our outreach to the community so that we don't run into problems as the plants move forward. So, yes, we try and catch those right up front.
All right, we'll get to it. My name is Brett Morgan, CEO of Morgan Automotive. We're the largest retail automotive franchise dealer group in the state of Florida. And I appreciate the committee for having me today. Just quickly about myself, I'm 20 years in automotive. Been at the helm of Morgan Auto Group for about half that time. We represent 66 locations. We have 6,000 employees in the state of Florida, and we represent over 29 unique brands, including Toyota. Furthermore, I'm an NADA Dealer Academy and a student of our business. But full disclosure, I'm also an EV consumer. So I've been driving an EV. I am not anti-EV since 2021. I've overseen all of our efforts related to EV infrastructure at Morgan Automotive and work hand-in-hand with our operators on the retail and marketing related to EVs. We have about 30 standalone models of EVs that we sell across those 26 brands today. There's a couple of reasons that I'm here today. First of all, I have a real fear that EVs and the conversation about EVs has kind of gotten a little too far down the road from what our consumers are ready for, prepared for, and what they want. I think the narrative around EV adoption has gotten highly political. I'm highly fearful of federal government mandates and controls removing consumer choice from the equation, forcing us to stock products that, frankly, consumers don't want to buy. And I'm going to show you some data today, individual case studies from our dealerships that points just to that. I'm also fearful that practical stepping stones such as hybrids and plug-in hybrids, many of which we can't offer for sale in the state of Florida because they are preferenced for the ZEV and CARB states, are being disregarded in this greater conversation as we, you know, move towards lower tailpipe emissions. Even our existing stock of EVs are much slower turning than current hybrid and ICE models, meaning consumers don't want what we currently have. So, again, why I've become vocal, the EPA mandate has proposed emission standards that would effectively require 67.5% of U.S. vehicles to be electric by 2032. This is unrealistic, to say the least, and would exacerbate many current issues and concerns that U.S. consumers have as it relates towards EV adoption. The affordability in transportation, I'd say up until now, most EVs have remained mainly a luxury product. And to points brought up prior to me speaking today, it's typically a second vehicle for many consumers. I would say that, you know, the charging infrastructure is a concern of a lot of consumers, and where a lot of people live, they can't just throw a level two charger on the wall to satisfy their needs. Raw material sourcing from for lithium battery production is also a concern. The ability of legacy manufacturers and dealerships to remain profitable when they're creating vehicles at a greater cost, you know, creating great incentives to get them to be appealing in the market, and then ultimately the dealer has to sell them at a lower profit because they're not ultimately what consumers are choosing. You know, when I look at the data of current EV leaders by state, you know, the state of Florida, about 6%, between 6 and 7% of new vehicles that will be sold in the state of Florida this year are electric vehicles. But I would remind you that less than a percent and a half of what is on the road today would be considered an electric vehicle. The EPA is counting on a massive increase in EV adoption of 10 times that. Currently, only 9 states outside of the state of California have higher than a 10% EV share of new car sales, and all are less than 20%. And many of these states' current leaders from a percentage of adoption standpoint are located in the carbon ZEB states. So, you know, one thing I'd like to say from a production standpoint, we're kind of facing a challenge. The train's kind of felt like it's already left the station to some degrees. And in summary, California, you know, has leveraged what began as a unique smog problem in Los Angeles to becoming a global leader in greenhouse gas policy. There have been many attempts to reduce California's authority in the matter, but current production and sales concerns are largely based on past administrations allowing California, from a federal perspective, and their policy to govern standards related to tailpipe emissions. Under Biden, who reinstated the California's Clean Air Act waiver, California opted for retroactive enforcement of policy, putting manufacturers in a real bind, for example. And they're big in the heavy-duty space, and we have 11 Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram stores, so I can speak pretty effectively to this, kind of behind the eight ball. And, you know, the result, just looking within that brand alone, is they're bringing a plug-in hybrid Wrangler and Grand Cherokee that consumers don't want to the market. And they're also getting rid of their, you know, their muscle cars, the Charger and Challenger, which will be replaced with electronic drivetrains moving forward. And I don't think my consumers understand that this is kind of already, this is happening now. So quick case study, just jumping into, and I want to say this, these aren't, you know, electric vehicles. You know, I've seen a lot of electric vehicles come to the market in the last decade, and these are outstanding vehicles. These are vehicles I'd be happy to drive, and I'm proud to sell. But this is just looking into kind of day supply data. You can see the total sales of the Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Hyundai Ioniq 6 in a couple of our Hyundai stores, one in Metro Fort Myers and one in Metro Tampa. You can see what we've sold for the year and how many we currently have in stock. At the very end of each data point is my average new car day supply. That's for the brand as a whole within that store. So you can see where kind of EVs sit versus my usual turn data. And you can see a baseline of, it takes about, well, in the bare minimum cases, I hold an electric vehicle about 5 times as long as I do an internal combustion engine. So you can see I've got a 246-day supply and 199-day supply of these Ioniqs versus my average turn of 24 and 36 days. For the Kia EV6 and EV9, I used one of my Jacksonville stores. We have 10 in stock. We've sold 16 for the year, so I have a 208-day supply on the ground, and I'm typically turning my inventory. This is inclusive of that, those EV data, by the way. I did not take them out of our day supply data of 44 days. Similar story for the Kia Niro EV. The Volkswagen ID.4 is probably one of the, I'd say, EVs that's been in the market the longest. It's one of the more mature EV models that we retail. And from just a pure volume perspective, one of the most, probably up there as far as a volume leader. And you can see even the ID.4 relative to what I have in stock and what I've sold for the year, you know, we're pushing 100 to 200 day supply on that vehicle when the average turn of everything else is 33 and of all new Volkswagens that I sell are 33 and 55 days retrospectively. In recent conversations with, you know, our local, our federal legislators, our local congresspeople, one thing that surprised me was they're like, well, the Ford's got to be selling exceedingly well. We've heard great things about that product. If you want a Ford Lightning, I've got them. And it's a great product. And I sold one to my brother-in-law, and he loves it. So as long as you're not towing, and there's some concerns as far as the range degradation when you're towing something heavy. But other than that, it's a fantastic vehicle, and it can power your party or your house if your power goes out. But again, look at my day's supply. 400 days supply of Lightnings at Gator Ford. That's a big, beautiful store right off of I-4 outside of Tampa and Sneffner, and then Ford of Port Richey. I've got 133 days supply. And again, you know, we, you know, coming out of COVID, you know, there was a time where our inventory was certainly suppressed, but we try to keep our, just so you know, a benchmark, we try to keep our new cars day supply operating under about 60. That's where we kind of get to a threshold of concern. I had a friend of mine is the CEO of Cars.com. I'm sure you've heard of Cars.com if you haven't used it to source information for your own retail consumer purchases. But he said he could provide to me consideration data as far as how Florida relates to the rest of the United States. So you can see here that as far as folks that are in the process of buying a car, you know, what percentage would consider an EV? It's about 25% nationally, and that's a little bit down from Q1 as it sits today. So 26.8% in Q1, 25%. The state of Florida was actually outpacing the national numbers or by a small here in Q1, but we're now down drastically to 14.8. So in the last four quarters, 10% fewer consumers say that they would adopt or interested in adoption of an electric vehicle. Now, I think some of this is because the early adopters have made their choices as consumers, and I think some of it's because the media has finally begun to cover some of the, you know, maybe the truth as it relates to the bigger conversation that we should be having about electric vehicles. So, you know, why should we maybe temper or slow our roll or have a bigger conversation about, you know, hybrids and other technologies and how they play a role as we walk towards lower tailpipe emissions? Well, for one, U.S. policy is forcing the hand of car manufacturers already to produce more EVs than consumers currently want. I say we're kind of out kicking the coverage, and it's true, and we're already seeing it now. I was so much looking forward to this year to have the variety of EV products to be able to compete in the marketplace with the likes of Tesla, because granted, they've, you know, fundamentally kind of dominated the space. And we've got some great, terrific products out there. But to be sitting here before you today already kind of screaming on behalf of the consumer that it's not what they want and adoption is having even slow, you know, more slowly than what we'd anticipate, I'm not excited about that. Consumer adoption of EVs will take education and for it to organically happen over time. Federal tax incentives have largely been enjoyed by early EV adopters and the wealthy, and these incentives have not influenced those slow to adopt. EVs are not profitable for the legacy manufacturers to sell, as I know. And at the point that they're slow to sell at my lots, they are sold at a reduced profit. We need time to develop the charging infrastructure for consumers. I think in our locations, we're investing heavily in Stellantis stores alone. Morgan Automotive is investing $6 million in charging infrastructure across those 12 dealerships. You know, we need time for the battery technology to grow in efficiency and for EV ranges to improve, I think, for the consumer to gain interest. And I think we might be selling a false narrative. We just don't have the data yet that in many ways that are unproven, such as that EVs are cheaper to maintain. I can remember being in Dallas last year during the NADA convention, and based on increased rates in many markets, powering an electric vehicle was more expensive than it was through, fossil fuels. Any questions?
Thank you for your presentation. Representative LaMarca, you get the first crack.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Morgan. I think you laid out a really interesting case. I guess the question toward the end of that conversation was you spoke quite a bit about with respect to kind of who there's a dominator in the market with respect to EVs. I think what concerns me is we have businesses throughout the state of Florida and the United States of America, domestic and non-domestic brands, who have invested heavily, not just in manufacturing, but also a dealer model and all that. And you're competing with somebody who's, selling a battery that happens to have a vehicle wrapped around it online. And there's very few, they have much less investment in that space. I guess maybe can you talk about that in comparison to what you have to do for these dealerships that you have for all the different brands for EVs?
Yeah, I would, first off, I'll speak out of both sides of my mouth about Tesla. I have the utmost respect for Tesla. Bringing a quality vehicle, of any kind to market and doing so without, a great deal of marketing as Tesla has, hats off to that. But I think what you see, even in their recent price reductions, is that they're trying desperately to keep hold of the market share they have as it relates to EV. They can see that, consumers want choice and they have a lot more choices in the market today. And they're doing everything they can to hold on to that market share. And I think it's just coming at a time where you also have kind of adoption rates dropping off quite substantially. From a value add, I joke all the time with my friends, hey, go buy that Tesla. They're not going to support your local Little League team, right? So, we spend a lot of money in our communities and reinvest a lot of our profits to support the municipalities that you represent. And I think that dynamic is gone with Tesla. I'm not afraid of Tesla by any means. I'm not, worried that what they're their existence means for mine. I don't think success is, I think it's mutually exclusive in the point that I think we can both live and service customers and learn from each other. We've certainly learned from some of the ways that Tesla does business. But again, yeah, there are some, our ability to service customers and, CapEx expense investments that we make in certain markets, Tesla would have gotten there a lot faster had they utilized the franchise dealer network. And you see some of these other manufacturers are kind of struggling now. Rivian's been a company since, I think, 2006. But, my brother-in-law, who ended up with the Lightning, was looking at a Rivian. Well, he would have had to driven to Richmond, Virginia from Roanoke to service his vehicle. And that was problematic for him. And I think a lot of people with the Lucids and the, some of these other entrants into the EV fray kind of face the same thing. So there is, I think, a unique value that we provide inside of that franchise network. And then there's also the redeployment of, our revenue into charities, into, projects from a local level that you don't have with a Tesla. Does that answer your question, Representative?
It did very much. And I'm just going to give you a quick follow-up, not a question, but the slide that you shared with us that said your fears, thank you for putting some, important thoughts out there. Your experience in the industry is obviously something that shouldn't be underrated, and the fact that you've laid out some concerns as a business owner and a dealer, it's important for us to be able to hear that, and I think people outside of this room and outside of this state should hear that.
Well, consumers vote with their pocketbooks, and I just feel like their voice is not being accounted for kind of at this point in the conversation.
I got a quick question for you. So on one of the slides that you had a pretty significant drop in consideration for EVs. You showed that from 27.3 to 14. Just your thoughts. Why do you think that is?
I think it's threefold. I think it's affordability. You look at where, consumer interest rates, I think, average transaction on a new car was between 9% and 10% interest rate. I think that's adding to it. So consumers are looking for things on the lower end of the spectrum, which is not going to be inclusive of EVs because of the price of technology. I think some of it is that the early adopters are getting, that market is saturated. And I think the other half of it is, frankly, that the news media is finally covering some of these kind of the unsexy parts of EVs. I used to joke all the time, you know, Elon Musk doesn't have to spend money advertising EVs. The New York Times does it for him. And there's some truth to that. I think, but those three, I think, confounding effects together are the reason that you see that consideration, you know, really, really dropping in Florida.
Representative McFarland, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks again for being here. It's not a market that I follow super well, but your case study slide was interesting to me. On the is the sales cycle slower for EVs? Like your number of days on hands of vehicles, is it just the sales cycle is slower? Like perhaps a customer needs to like kick the tires 3 more visits before they buy an EV?
I wouldn't imagine so. No, I wouldn't imagine so, but I don't even know how you'd necessarily arrive at that data point. You know, you're either, you know, somebody who's would consider an EV and needs more education, more information, maybe some firsthand experience. But I think, you know, again, going back to the value that the franchise dealer network provides, and I think, you know, for me, it, you know, it wasn't in, you know, environmental or any other influence that led me towards EV other than I can't put a gas station in my garage. And I can afford to put a level 2 charger. Not everybody can. But the driving experience of an EV is, in my opinion, superior than driving an internal combustion engine. Now, I'll argue this with fellow car guys and friends. But, you know, we give the obviously the test drivability to consumers. So I don't think the buying cycle is any longer.
So it looks like you have between, depending at which dealership and which model, you have between 4 and 31, I think was the highest of numbers of vehicles in stock. Is that about average for inventory that you have on hand for other vehicles?
It varies from market to brand, depending on how much volume that given brand represents. It was just, I thought it was better to see it from an actual dealership level rather than as a whole, because it kind of dilutes just how dramatic. You know, I took out, I didn't include, you know, Ford data from some of our rural stores, because frankly, there's no interest. You know, part of what we have to understand is there's a part of this country and in part of this state where, you know, people live in rural outlying areas and they don't have any interest in EVs. So our Lake City stores weren't, you know, I didn't have data from our Lake City stores, for instance.
All right.
I got one more.
One more.
Right. So, it's actually following up on what you just said, it looks like your EV days supply for your Ford vehicles is like orders of magnitude higher than the other manufacturers. Is that driven by manufacturer quotas in Ford?
Well, in the purest sense, you know, stocking levels need to be predicated upon consumer demand, which means sales. And I think because it's a product that's just, you know, so new, that's not practical, right? So a lot of that was based on Ford's projections of how these vehicles would do in the marketplace. And I don't know if you saw in the news yesterday, Ford is, I think, slashed production in the Lightning by 50%. So it's, you know, it's something timely. It's in the news. And a lot of that's probably because they're looking at the very same data points that I'm, you know, sharing with you today.
All right. Representative Alvarez, you are recognized.
First of all, thank you for coming. You know, I know you come from our area, and we're very proud that you would actually take the time. And I mean, I'll use the word courage, because it takes a lot to be a market leader and then say, I don't have a lot of faith in the way the market's running right now. You know, so I applaud you for doing that. And it's funny, because I believe that you echo some of the thought that as we are trying to do good governance, right, small government that is effective, we have the opportunity to create the system instead of later on down the line go, you know, government, just let it happen. So we're at a point where we can make it happen smartly. And that's where we are with EVs. And there's a great sense, as we discuss this all the time, that we're not sure where to even begin wrangling it, right? Because we don't know if it's the horse or the buggy, which one's coming first. If you were us, and I'm talking about Florida only, because right now that's what we're in charge of, right? How do we create or roll out an effective program that allows consumers to have the vehicles they want, but the infrastructure and system that we can provide as a government to make sure it's there for the whole?
That's a great question. And I'm not sure I have all your answers.
That's all right. What would you recommend, like, off the top of your head?
You know, I think the conversation really starts with just becoming educated. And right now, what I see is the dealers yelling at the factory and the factory is pointing at the government. And I mean from a federal perspective, right? There's a certain, you know, even as, you know, Florida legislators, there's certain conversations that we're just not a part of. And that's a little maybe disheartening. You know, I think from an infrastructure perspective, I have faith that the charging network's coming along. You know, I was pressed by, you know, one of our Florida congresswomen on, well, what's a more reasonable, you know, and balanced goal at the end of the rainbow here? And I think I said something to the degree of, maybe 50% EV adoption in 20, 25 years. And you said it, I love the metaphor of we're kind of putting the cart before the horse. That's 100% of what's happening here. And I just see a lot of negatives, you know, going back to the conversations of hybrids and other solutions here. A lot of the great plug-in hybrids are not getting shipped to the state of Florida because we're not a CARB and ZEV state. So they're not even in the mode. They're not even in our data or in the prospect of consideration because they're not being delivered here. When hybrids first dropped, I was selling cars. So this is 2005, 2006. Nobody wanted an Accord hybrid or a Camry hybrid or a Civic hybrid because they, in their minds, couldn't justify the additional expense of the battery in the drivetrain. The value proposition wasn't there. It wasn't until Toyota had the Prius, in which there's no comparable drivetrain, where hybrid vehicles really got traction. I think, you know, today or within the last 5 years, the American consumer is finally 100% comfortable with hybrid. And it's why manufacturers are able to move to a, hey, you want that Sienna, it's 100% hybrid. If the consumers weren't comfortable, they wouldn't be able to do that. So I think there's, certainly using hybrid technology and leveraging plug-in hybrids. You know, we talk about the resources, the resource component to this. There's also a bigger picture that China's sitting on 70% of the, raw materials that it takes to, create a lithium battery for a battery electric vehicle, and that they plan on, manufacturing vehicles in Mexico. And if we're bending, so hard on EVs and, the Chinese entry will be at a lower cost. And that could be detrimental to not only the domestic business, but also the import manufacturers that manufacture here in the United States.
One follow-up. So, sir, is it an accurate statement to say that but for government intervention, intentional or unintentional, the market is not truly a commercial market that we can rely on? It is a false market.
You know, there was supposed to be kind of a meeting with the manufacturers back in 2016 as it relates to seeing if California policy needed to be adjusted, taking into account consumer demand. So what was the actual want, from the consumers for these levels of technologies? Kind of how was it going? On the way out, the Obama administration decided, hey, this meeting doesn't need to take place. The standards are fine. Then Trump came in and, basically remove the waiver of California to dictate policy. So you've got this kind of yin and yang from one extreme to the other. But to the reality, I think even based on current direction, there's some concern. And I just feel like those conversations aren't happening.
Thank you for
Representative Yeager.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Morgan, thank you for being here today and take the time to what Rep. Alvarez said. Appreciate the courage to come up here and do this. I want to get into the math of just the business of this. So on average, what's it for an average dealer? I'm going to give your data here, but an average dealer, what's it cost per day to keep a car in inventory?
Well, based on current floor plan rates, just based on, because some of that is variable expense, it can cost up to $1,000 for a 30-day period to stock a vehicle. Of of significant value, but obviously there's a lot in play there, right? You know, what's the cost of the vehicle? What's your floor plan rate? Are you floor planned with, et cetera, et cetera? But there is, thank you for addressing that there is a cost to stocking a new vehicle.
No, thank you. So, I mean, if you look at the Ford Mach, just doing quick math on the day supply, market supply, I mean, that's $372,000 it costs a dealer to keep electric vehicles just in stock with the demand or lack of demand, of course, say. So, I mean, that's where, like you said, you're turning stuff in 45 days on other inventory. It's not costing you near that much, right? So, in turn, this car's only costing you more up front, but it's costing the dealership more, which is just digging the major profits for you guys across the board.
Yeah, and not reflected in our data, but our Ford leaders would tell you that they've sold a lot of our BEV vehicles for commercial purposes. They've gone out and found people where it's practical, where they're comfortable with the technology and kind of push the sale. So, not all of our retail sales reflected there are actual retail consumers. They're businesses in which we said, please, we'll make you a great deal.
Just one follow-up statement. I think you talk about Morgan Automotive Group, largest dealer in Florida, but you have to realize, too, that there's also individual stores. There's individual dealers on one store. They're having to accrue the same cost, right, to do these EVs, and they're having to put the infrastructure in, and they're hitting this $1,000 a day paying for that car to sit on their lot that consumers don't want at the rate of what the federal government, what we're trying to push at, right? I mean, I think that's a fair statement. That's a big impact on business and small business in this country, in this state. I'm done. Sorry.
All right. You got Rep. Griffiths up now, and then Campbell, you're on deck.
Thank you. We appreciate you being here today. 66 dealerships, 6,000 employees. Thank you for being a job creator in Florida. That's a big deal. If we line up all your salesmen and talk to them, what would their opinions on be trying to sell hybrid, gas, electric? What are their opinions on this? Is it easier to sell one versus the other? And what kind of percentage would you say of those three automobiles is the sell price? I mean, what is the sell? What is it, the gas, the hybrid, which sells more?
Well, it's the gas and it's the hybrid. I think our salespeople would say it's easier to sell on part because I think the EV side, it's a lifestyle. And you have to understand, almost consume it. It's why I first jumped in an EV. I really wanted to understand the lifestyle change, the idea of going out on a date night, parking a car at an EV charger because I didn't have one at home to be able to get home. I mean, I really had to go through that experience. I would say, it's something that we talk about all the time. Do our salespeople have the education to be able to explain and satisfy the questions of the consumer? I even saw an article that said, part of the problem is the franchise dealer, dealership environment isn't as educated as they need to be. Well, guess what? I have a friend who owns an electrical charging company. He puts in level 2 charges at residences. He does the training for the local Tesla store because they don't have all the answers either. So, if you think about somebody who's, maybe been selling cars for less than, just a handful of years, the technology is fairly new. So it is on us to increase that level of education, I think, which will have an effect on consumer confidence. But if the Tesla store is, struggling with that, those conversations, then I feel a little bit better. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much. And a follow-up. We talk about the infrastructure, the lack of infrastructure for these EVs. Has there any consideration or discussion amongst your peer group, say, for instance, hypothetically, Hillsborough, Pinellas, that part of the world, Miami-Dade is struck by a very dangerous hurricane. There's evacuation orders. What type of infrastructure is going to be needed if we're at a 60% EV with cars on the road? These people can drive X miles. You're sitting at a charging station for 20 minutes with 5,000 cars in line to get the same charge. What kind of infrastructure level do we think we need in the state of Florida to prepare for those disasters?
That's probably a mathematical equation that far outkicks what I'm capable of delivering. But while we're talking kind of about, emergency management, I'll say two things. I think 5 years ago, and I forget which storm it was, but people were exiting the state of Florida and Tesla extended the range. They were able to wirelessly, get inside the vehicle and make them more efficient and extend the range of their drivers. And some people said, hey, I'm not cool with that. You're playing God over here. While we appreciate the assistance, that's a problem. Right now there's not enough EVs on the road, especially non-Tesla, because, you know, Tesla's supercharging network is, you know, just insular to them. It will open to, you know, over time to other manufacturers. So there's just not enough EVs on the road, I think, for you to really hear the consumer cry out that it's a problem. I think another issue as it relates to emergency management is what saltwater can do to a lithium battery. So, you know, where I live in Tampa, even though the last hurricane, Idalis, was 130 miles to the north of me, we had a super tide. I had 12, 15 inches of water in my garage. I had to move both the EVs in the household to a parking garage, and I had a lifted Jeep Wrangler ICE engine sitting in my front yard in case we needed to get out, because we have water on both sides where I live. You know, going back to my friend who owns that charging company in his neighborhood in Dunedin, he watched three Teslas go up in flames. And this guy is EV, a believer as there is. And he watched three go up in flames as it relates to the corrosion causing fires in those lithium ion batteries. So I think that's a concern too. I think we need to, you know, keep asking questions and have conversations before we run and rubber stamp a policy without consideration for what it could do.
Rep. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you talk a little bit more on the feedback that you're hearing from customers regarding EV products and gas products?
Well, I would say, generally speaking, our consumers would tell you, and again, I'm trying to generalize feedback here, that the technology is just too expensive. So I want to, you know, just from an MSRP perspective, I think the most inexpensive EV that I have to sell is probably in the ballpark between $39,000 and $42,000. So I think the consumer would tell you it's too expensive at this point. Then I think they have other questions that'll just take time for them to understand better, whether it's range anxiety, you know, how to charge it. You know, while we talked about the fires as it relates to our emergency management, you know, occasionally these vehicles have fires that are unrelated to, you know, saltwater corrosion, that kind of damage. I think, you know, the media intensifies, you know, those stories. So the reality is, if you look at the data set, EVs are safe to buy. But once that's planted in someone's mind that, you know, they might not be safe to drive or park in the garage, you know, that's something that we're left to overcome as well. So I think it's a, you know, the consumer has more than one concern. I think some of it's price driven right now. I think some of it's we live in a big state. You know, you want to drive from Tampa to Miami. It's difficult to do on a single charge, though I've done it. In some markets, again, you know, there's a disparity between the charging infrastructure that exists in different markets, because the charging infrastructure came later to Jacksonville. It's better tech. You can charge quicker than you can in Tampa. Part of that's just when that, you know, city adopted the technology, the public-facing technology that exists.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
Can you tell me what happens to those cars, those EV cars that you don't sell?
Well, as a car dealer, I'm going to sit here and tell you that we sell everything, right? So, and that's, you know, that's a great question. But my friends ask me that all the time, and they've asked me that recently. You know, what happens to the vehicles you don't sell? The answer is, you know, we can't hand them back in. At some point, the manufacturer gives you what they call a final pay allowance or a final pay incentive. And you write down the cost of that car, and you sell it at whatever price you can. But it's, you know, as the retailer from the distributor level, it's on us to sell those vehicles. So in some cases, they become leadership of Morgan Automotive's demos if it really becomes that problematic. We're having those conversations right now. We may have a whole fleet of our leadership team driving Jeep Wrangler 4xEs because they're just not selling. But good question. But no, ultimately, you know, we don't have any abilities other than to retail them and find somebody to have them.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair. How much, you mentioned in your slide that one of the things that you see needed is that we need more time for infrastructure, we need more time to develop a better battery. And we know federally they've already said 2032, I think you said on your slide. For you, how much time do you feel is needed to have a charging infrastructure, to have a battery technology that can handle, since it seems like it's a path that folks are starting to go, or the government is starting to go down on EVs?
I heard this recently, and I don't know if it's true, but I've heard the magic numbers for consumers are a full charge in 14 minutes and 600 miles of range. So that gives you an idea of, I think, where the consumer says, okay, I still have, you know, these two or three concerns, but you've answered my two biggest ones. As it relates, you know, time to get, you know, current infrastructure in place, not infrastructure that can provide that ability yet, because that, you know, even if you push 350 kilowatts an hour from a charger, you know, that car can still only accept so much. Most of these cars can only accept about 200 kilowatts an hour now. I think probably the right way to answer the question is, you know, what percentage of EV adoption is feasible a year as far as what we'd consider sustained growth and a move towards greener tailpipe emissions? You know, and I'd say kind of the current, you know, current spectrum that we're on, you know, 2 to 3%, 2% a year, something along those lines. But again, we want that driven by consumers, I think. We don't want it driven by policy.
Representative Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation. Very, very insightful. You've touched on it a bit, but I have some concerns, obviously, with this lack of educational component. You know, really what we're asking consumers to do is change learned social behavior, and it's a forced change learned social behavior, right? We've worked and driven gasoline cars since they've been invented. So to ask consumers in this short period of time, change your way of thinking, and we're going to force you to move to something else. Do you believe that that educational component to convince consumers for you to meet this mandate is going to fall on all of our local business owners and manufacturers and dealers, where you're going to be changing your marketing strategy from, let me talk to you about the vehicles of car I have, to now educating consumers on the benefits of these types of vehicles just so we can meet that mandate? And do you believe that's going to fall on you, or do you see anything from the federal government that's going to provide any support for you, for that assistance to educate consumers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. No, at this point, I would say that I feel like that's really on our shoulders, is to better communicate kind of what EV ownership, what it looks like, what it feels like, what it sounds like. I think going way back, you know, there was a lot of people that just said, hey, look, in a EV, you lose liquid services. They're going to be a lower cost to maintain. Right? There's going to be a lower cost to power. Once these vehicles get into competitive pricing range with ICE vehicles, that the adoption will happen organically. I think we're pretty close to that now, and I'm not seeing it. I think there has to be a tremendous cost benefit for someone just to jump because of cost. Right? I mean, I can remember talking to a Stanford professor in 2015. He said, well, it's going to be the convergence of, you know, BEVs with autonomously driven vehicles. Starbucks is going to be taking you to work because the cost of transportation will be reduced by 10x. And I said, that's great. Well, if you've been following the headlines, I don't think autonomously driven vehicles are anywhere in the peripheral. So I think he kind of missed the mark there. And there is, you know, questions about what does a complete disruption of oil and gas, what would it do to our country anyway, and is that a positive? I get to just ask the question sometimes. I don't have to deal with the answers.
All right, Representative Caruso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you, sir, for you clearly are in the trenches, and I appreciate your pragmatic stance with regards to EVs. You know, you're saying it like it really is, and I think it's important. We all know that there's a lot of problems with EVs, and you mentioned that we should walk before we run, and clearly the federal government is sprinting towards an unrealistic end here. You've pretty much answered my questions. Of all the concerns that consumers have, though, driving distance, charging time, charging locations, availability, cost of purchase, cost to buy, to maintain, which one do you think is the overriding one that's keeping consumers from buying EVs?
I would say it's probably coupled range anxiety with charging infrastructure.
Range.
You know, because seeing's believing. So when, you know, I think people see the infrastructure, they start to feel a little bit better. But I think those two, and a lot of consumers also, you know, one aspect that we haven't talked about and would be like use vehicle case scenario, in which a lot of people, you know, want to talk about how long is the battery going to, you know, is it realistic for the battery to last? And they, you know, I think consumers have a relative idea of what the cost of these batteries are. We went through this a little bit with hybrids too, right? You know, that's a, you know, that battery costs, you know, X dollars in a warranty. That's crazy. But I think, you know, there's some concern there too, as to, you know, if I, the kind of consumer keeps my vehicle for 10, 11 years and this battery fails, am I going to be, you know, spending 50% of the value of the car to keep it running?
Follow up, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you give us an estimate of the charging stations that we see out there? I've kind of, as I drive my 7 hours from Palm Beach County to Tallahassee, I stop at the rest stops and on the turnpike, and I go to the different charging stations there. I don't have an EV. I don't have that want that extra hour and a half to charge my vehicle or wait for a charging station when I come to Tallahassee. But I notice about maybe one out of five are non-operational. And I'm wondering, do you know the statistic on that? Mine is...
There was a story in Automotive News, I think it was 14 to 16 months ago, that put I think units, you know, that were in operation but not operable at something like 20-25% of charging stations. And a lot of it's because they're antiquated tech and just not properly maintained. A lot of it's because the charge points of the world, you know, don't have the capacity for this level of maintenance at this time. So that's a concern. That's a great point. You know, you go around like the city of St. Pete, where I lived for 12 years, and I remember one time I was down to 2 miles in an EV. And my daughter and I had a nice 2 hours at the park that day, because all they had four stations, and I think three were DC superchargers. They were all down. So we got on the level 2 9, you know, kilowatt an hour machine. And, you know, an hour and a half later, we were able to drive 15 minutes home. But I think that's a valid concern is maintenance of these networks as well. We're going to go through it as a company after, you know, we've made the investment now, and they'll start going in the ground in 6 months.
Representative Gottstein.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you also for me for coming out today, sir. I wondered, what are the thoughts on high density needs for charging? And the reason I ask is a lot of Florida's beachfronts, including my district has 18,000 people among an 8 mile long strip along the beach. These condos with 2,000-3,000 people per these high-rises wish to have an EV charging station for every other car or every car. And the HOAs meet, and this goes on and on. What is the level of the industry looking into, and I know this is an FPNL and other energy question, what is the level of interest and progress being made for people in these communities? Thank you.
Yeah, I would, again, you know, I could represent, you know, what we're doing as it relates to charging infrastructure. I'd remind you, not all of our locations are convenient to where our consumers who buy actually live. You know, and I think about, you know, South Florida, where a large part of South Florida is, you know, 20-30 miles in diameter, or however you want to say it. And again, I can see some real... you know, challenges. You see what has been going on in Manhattan as it relates to these Chinese scooters that have caused fires in apartment buildings and deaths. And, you know, it seems like every time I'm in New York and turn on the news, there's a story about an electric scooter that caused a fire. And I have a friend who's a property manager there, and she's like, look, it's a real issue. It's a real concern. I think you're seeing some of that, that, you know, that property owners, building owners are wary of that. And I don't know if it's
it's feasible in that use case scenario to provide enough charging for 70% EV adoption. I just don't know if it's, how would it be practical, frankly. You'd need a really proven network of high-speed level 3 DC chargers that were readily available to the consumer nearby in close proximity. And I think at that point, if you didn't have that 14 to 15 minute charge about what it, the time it takes to get gas, which includes a bathroom break in my math, I think that, yeah, I don't know how you'd justify that as a consumer, to be honest.
Thank you.
Representative Kennedy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, what a breath of fresh air. Thank you for the transparent conversation as we think about the risk-benefit analysis on all of this, which is so important. You know, as we legislators sit around and have lunchtime conversations or dinner conversations, this is what we're talking about. These are big, important issues, so thank you. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal on Sunday that went through kind of a dealer's perspective. I don't know if anybody saw it, but I was very interested in it. And one of the things that I found interesting was it really identified these three areas, range, reliability, and price, as primary kind of points of pain on EVs. But it said something that I thought was interesting, and it really highlighted advertised range as being a significant issue. And it specifically talked about the impact of cold weather on range. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, in Florida, I had to scrape ice off my windshield the other morning. We don't think a lot about that, but could you talk just a little bit more about that range issue and whether the article mentioned that there were significant numbers of consumers actually bringing cars back to the dealers because of the range issue?
Yeah, so, you know, I can't answer the question about cold weather because we don't have any significant enough for me to worry about it. But I will say this about, and again, I don't have the data in front of me, but hot weather can have the same effect, can degrade the, from what I understand, these batteries have liquid, they need to be cooled. So again, that can be affected by, you know, think about it like cooling your car. That can be affected by supreme cold weather conditions, but also affected by hot weather conditions as well. So I think some of that range degradation happens in Florida. I can remember when we, you know, I think it was the i3 or that first, that little BMW that we used to sell, that was one of our first fully electric cars in that stable. And I think the range was like 85 miles. And I remember a factory rep telling me, well, and, you know, in Florida summer is probably only going to do 60. So, make sure the consumer knows that. And that's wild. I'll tell you another story. I had this is a personal story. I won't tell you the brand, but it was a luxury manufacturer of EV. The range degradation was 20% in a year and a half of driving that vehicle. And again, the conditions in which the factory would say would yield to that are typically, okay, you were at a DC charger every day of your life. I was not. It was a level 2. Now, I did charge the vehicle to 100% every night, which, again, can also quicken the degradation of range. You know, the manufacturers typically represent that you should only charge to 80. It's not that I was uninformed. I think I was just lazy. But, I mean, to lose 20% of your range in a calendar year, that seemed pretty extreme to me. Now, I had since had a very same model vehicle. I did not have that same experience over that same period of time. But I thought that was pretty wild.
One more. Representative LaMarca.
Okay, I have one more question for you, sir, and I appreciate your being here. So you gave us some numbers as with respect to what you've got on lots and what are being produced from the EV section. What's the do you happen to know what the total percentage or number of vehicles in the state of Florida is on the roads for EVs?
I think it's about, from a, if just looking like pure registration basis,
right,
I think it's about less than 1.5% of the total vehicles on Florida's roads are plug-in hybrids or plug-in electrics or electric, fully electric vehicles.
So, and we're to get to 67.5%
of new cars sold.
Well, eventually they're going to be sold and they'll be on the road and they'll register, right?
I think it's asking a lot.
You know, if we're at 6% and I see the data screaming to say that in, you know, less than 10 years, we're going to get to 67.5% 10 times.
Okay. So bonus round, if I could.
Sure.
Mr. Wimmer and Mr. Morgan, some of the two of the brightest people that I think have come before this committee or any committee I've been in, can either of you analytically, mathematically, statistically explain the college football playoff system to me?
Not just saying this because of where I am, but I know Florida State got hosed, and that's tough. That's tough. That's tough All for right. me to stomach.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I actually have one quick question myself, and it's a little bit in regards to insurance rates between your regular combustible engines and EVs. And I've been trying to track down some data, and with only 1.5% on the road, it's kind of hard to get a good number on it. But can you talk a little bit about what the difference of the insurance rates? You know, so I'm from Cape Coral. We had EVs catching on fire during Ian. So we saw it, and I know that a lot of EVs are only made in a big couple of big pieces, and there's aluminum involved, and it's a little bit different, a little bit more challenging to build. Can you talk about the insurance rates at all?
So from what I understand and what I've seen with some of our customers is it can be cost twice as much to insure an electric vehicle as a comparably equipped internal combustion engine vehicle. The issue with the insurance companies, it relates to damage to the battery during a collision. So if you think about the average BEV battery costing $25,000 to manufacture, just using ballpark, if the battery's damaged during any kind of a collision, that's what's driving the cost. That's my understanding of the narrative. We've got 7 collision centers. I don't spend as much time as I probably should there. But from what I understand, that's the, you know, I think we have issues in the state of Florida as far as just having higher rates from a baseline perspective, from what I understand, from what the data tells me. But from a ICE car to an EV, that's what my understanding is, Representative.
So the scrap rates would of an EV is probably much higher than a regular car.
Like correct.
That. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Well, I really appreciate Mr. Morgan, Mr. Wimmer, for your time. These are extremely important issues, as Representative Kennedy said earlier. We're trying to learn more about Florida's energy posture and policy and figuring out what path that we take. We've had a number of briefings in Commerce. This is our second, kind of a second workshop or hearing we had in our committee on energy. And of course our, you know, electrical infrastructure, transportation is extremely important to the state of Florida. So thank you for your time. And members, with no more further business, Representative LaMarca says we adjourn.